Uncle Bunmi worries that maybe he killed too many people when he was in the war, and that's why he's being afflicted with this kidney thing. You know, he killed too many communists, or maybe it was too many mosquitoes.
Yes,
he says. I mean, sort of, they say, oh, you know, it's all about your intentions. Don't worry too much about it. And there are times when people sort of avoid stepping on insects, for example. And yet there's another scene where there's a bug zapper that we hear quite prominently in the soundtrack.
It's true. No, it's true.
Welcome to the Plastic Podcast. I'm Robert Davis. Today's episode of the podcast is actually a joint production with the AFI Fest Now website. That's the site that's covering the AFI Fest running in Los Angeles now through November 11th. I'll be joined momentarily by my podcasting colleague, J. Robert Parks, and the two of us took a look at the AFI Fest schedule, which is quite a strong program, and found a couple of movies that we thought we would highlight on the podcast. One is Uncle Bunmi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives, and the other is Certified Copy by Abbas Kiarostami, the new film starring Juliette Binoche. I like these movies a lot, both of them quite a bit. We're going to spend the next half hour talking about the first of those two, and then on another podcast that you can find the same place you found this one, we'll be talking about Certified Copy. And for more information about the festival, just go to blog.afi.com/AFIFest. You'll find these podcasts and all kinds of other articles, interviews, and information about the festival. Hey, J. Robert.
Hey, Rob.
So we're talking about a movie called Uncle Bunmi, Who Can Recall His Past Lives. And I think anyone who names their movie that deserves some respect right off the bat. But this isn't just anybody. This is Apichapong Wirasthakul from Thailand. He doesn't mind if you call him Joe. That's something I believe he picked up in Chicago.
Yeah, he was a student at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago for many years, and apparently projected at different movie places around the city area.
And I think Chicago is where he became a filmmaker.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But now he's making movies in Thailand, and
which is where he grew up.
Right. And his previous movie, Syndromes in a Century, was absolutely one of my favorites of the year, but one of my favorites probably of all time. Mm. It's just a very mind-blowing film, but also a very humble movie in a lot of ways. It's just a very strange movie, too.
Yes.
His movies don't work in typical narrative ways. No. They're very experimental in a lot of ways, but they do have a sense of character and place.
Yes.
And the new one, Uncle Bunmi, is no different. What'd you think of this movie?
You know, I like it. And there's lots to like. But for me, my favorites of his, and which I really like the two from before Syndrome of the Century, Blissfully Yours and Tropical Malady. This one reminds me of both of those in a variety of ways, and I'm sure we'll get to that. And so I like this one, but not quite as much as I like those earlier ones. What do you think?
Yeah, I have to admit being, I think, slightly disappointed, but it's only because of coming off of a pretty high peak, I think. I probably like this as well as Tropical Malady or some of his recent ones. It's about a man named Uncle Bunmi who seems to have a kidney condition, feels like maybe he's at the end of his life, and is commenting on past lives that he believes he can remember. I guess that's sort of the spine of the story, but it's just sort of a sequence of scenes that are built around that spine. And they don't necessarily draw a more full picture of the story or this man or his life necessarily. And I think that's what makes it a little bit alienating in some ways. I sometimes think of Joe as a guy who works on these, he has these layers. It's fun to think about who his movies are made for.
Yeah.
So you might think, well, in some sense, he studied film in the U.S. Mm. He seems to make references to a lot of films that we know from the canon. You know, whenever I see there's a sequence of still photos in Uncle Bunmi that instantly recalled Chris Marker, the French filmmaker Chris Marker, and I know that he has seen Chris Marker, and I firmly believe that that is an allusion to him. At the same time, he's making movies in Thailand with non-professional actors, very much drawing on the culture and beliefs there. Yep. So there's a second layer, a thick layer there. But then there's this third layer that is just his personal experience. His parents were doctors. I believe his father had a kidney condition. Mm. He's putting elements of himself into this film and not connecting them necessarily to anything else. And the movie sort of works in these three levels at once and even sort of jumps from one to the other.
mysteriously, and I like that.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite way to see a movie like this is just to sort of let it go, mm-hmm. you know? I think some people would approach a movie like that and feel very frustrated. I guess
because they want to try to map it out and they want to figure out exactly who is who.
It feels like it must be a puzzle that you're supposed to piece together. And what I like about his movies is that I do believe he has pieced something together in his head, but it isn't important for you to do that. Yeah. And in fact, he hasn't given you enough information to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you end up piecing together your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you find these sort of common themes. There seems to be very little boundary between humanity and nature
right.
in his movies, but especially this one. There are these sort of ape creatures with these red glowing eyes.
The ghost monkeys.
They, the result of a man mating with a monkey that and a ghost. I can't remember exactly how it works, but it's very interesting.
Although we don't see that on.
No, we don't see that. We do see the princess mate with a fish.
That's true.
Very stylized scene. One of my favorite scenes of the movie. It sounds strange to just describe it that way, but it becomes this sort of underwater swirl of water and bubbles, and it turns into this technical, tour de force for a few moments.
Yeah. It is. Yeah, that's one of my favorite scenes too. I think you're right that trying to sort of quite figure out what's going on it distracts you from, I think, the larger pleasures. Joe has just an incredible sense of place, particularly when he films in the jungle or in the rural areas. It's interesting that in a lot of his earlier films, they would start off in the city and then they would move to the countryside. Here, this one starts off in the countryside, and in fact, most of it is set there. But then there's a move to the city in the end. And that the contrast between sort of countryside and city, I think, is really profound, and there's a lot you can do with that. But just his command of sound, and particularly how the sounds of nature work, is really remarkable. I mean, the opening shot of Uncle Boonmi is of this water buffalo who's tied up. And I guess there's smoke, or it's not clear. Is it smoke? Is it a ghost? I'm not quite sure what's going on with this. But it takes place at night, and the evocative sound design that Joe has is so rich, and sort of it sets you in this mood of what the film is going to be. I find myself sort of surrendering to it and almost becoming hypnotized by it.
I think the sound design is kind of funny sometimes too. There is some talk of Uncle Boonmi worries that maybe he killed too many people when he was in the war, and that's why he's being afflicted with this kidney thing. You know, he killed too many communists, or maybe it was too many mosquitoes.
Yes,
he says. I mean, sort of. They say, oh, you know, it's all about your intentions. Don't worry too much about it. And there are times when people sort of avoid stepping on insects, for example. And yet, there's another scene where there's a bug zapper. That we hear quite prominently in the soundtrack.
It's true. It's true. It's interesting that theme of as Uncle Boonmi is dying or thinks he's dying. Part of the past lives he's recalling is in a very Buddhist sense, and so this scene you mentioned of the princess mating with a fish feels like a dream, but it also sort of feels like maybe he. Maybe he was the fish at one time, or maybe he was the princess. I don't know.
It suddenly feels ancient, too. Like this is an old story.
Yeah. But there's also sort of very contemporary references, like you say, to this. He wonders whether his affliction is because he killed too many communists, and his sister-in-law sort of tries to comfort. It's like, well, like you said, it's all about intentions. But it reminds me of a film I just saw a couple of weeks ago called Enemies of the People, which is a documentary set in Cambodia where this director was trying to sort of track down various people who had committed atrocities during the Khmer Rouge killing fields in the 70s. And it was interesting how many of the people that he interviews, that's what they wrestle with. They wrestle with what is their afterlife, what's coming for them because of these horrible things that they did. And indeed, for them, part of why they want to repent, so to speak, or at least to bear witness to what they did, is to somehow restore whatever good karma they can. And so I found that interesting that in this movie, there's obviously it's not a documentary in any way, but it had that sense of tapping into, I think, at least what sometimes people are thinking.
Yeah, and I think the story is, it's about literal reincarnation, But also there are these sort of figurative ways that it comes up too. There's a young man who goes to live as a monk for a short time, or at least he's supposed to, but he gets a sort of creeped out living out in the boonies and wearing the saffron robe. And he just sort of shows up in these people's apartment and they're like, hey, you're supposed to be out, you know. He takes off the saffron robe, he has a shower, he sort of becomes a normal person. It's almost like transforming from one identity into another. Yeah. Or there, Uncle Boonmi also has this nurse who he explains a couple of times is from Laos. And you get the sense that maybe you don't know anything about this guy's history, but you get the sense that maybe he had to make a move and a big change in his life. And you can imagine that it's almost like a clean break and a new identity in a new place. There is another scene where they're talking about different languages that they know. And he knows a little bit of French and he's practicing his French. And, you know, you just get the sense that even in life, you know, within a given lifetime, identities shift. And sometimes people are forced to, you know, be reincarnate as something different.
Absolutely, and that's a common theme in Joe's work. I mean, in Blissfully Yours, you know, we have these this sort of trio of people that we meet in the first half of the film, and one of them is actually sort of an illegal migrant from Burma, and he's trying to get a, I think, a health card, if I remember right, so he can get a job. And so there's two women in his life, one younger, one older, who are sort of trying to help him do this. And that goes on for a while. And then they take this day trip out into the countryside and into the jungle, and it becomes almost different people. And to the point where you're wondering, are these the same people? Have they become different? I'm not quite sure. Are we supposed to think that this same actor, but is he the same person? And in Tropical Malady, there's a similar kind of transformation where as people sort of move from one stage into another stage, they become, well, at one point, one of them becomes an animal. And so I think that idea of transformation is a really important theme.
Also, this idea in all three of the movies you just, well, the two movies you just mentioned, plus Syndromes in a Century, there's this idea that the movie is sort of split in half. There's the first half, and then it suddenly shifts to something completely different in the second half. And to think about them together and separate is always an interesting exercise. Yeah. It's a little bit like what Stanley Kubrick would do sometimes in some of his movies, but a little bit starker, a little bit stranger, I think, even in Joe's movies. And it's possible that some of my disappointment, which is minor, I have to say, I really liked Uncle Boonmi, but I think some of my minor disappointment has to do with its sort of amorphous structure. It definitely has those shifts, but it feels more like a series of vignettes almost, instead of a very clear and bold boom, part one, boom, part two. And I think something about structure appeals to me.
One of the interesting things, too, about Joe that I feel like it happens in a number of his films is how he interacts with the idea of folk tales. We've talked a couple times about this princess story in The Catfish, but the setup to that is actually somewhat different in that there's a procession going through the jungle at night where these various men are carrying the princess in this, you know, this little cart. And the way Joe shoots it, within about, I don't know, 10, 15 seconds, you know instantly what's going on. There's no dialogue. It's just sort of the way people look, but this servant is in love with the princess, which he shouldn't be, and the princess has feelings for the servant. And it's just amazing to me that he can communicate all of that in a very short amount of time with just very simple, you know, cut here, cut there, back and forth, and yet we know instantly. And I feel that way about a lot of his films, that as sometimes as complex as they are, there's also the simplicity of a folk tale that's very, very attractive.
Having started this discussion saying that you don't necessarily have to know what the filmmaker was thinking, I will say that I really enjoyed this time that he came to the Pacific Film Archive in Berkeley and showed Tropical Malady, but interactively stopping it periodically to talk about things. And he would take questions. You could raise your hand and say stop at any point. It was
really
a small group there, so it wasn't like a big giant audience of people. It was just, you know, you could say, oh, hey, Joe, what's the deal with that? It was one of the coolest things I've ever had the opportunity to experience, because it's sort of like a commentary track, but so much better, because you could, and I wish I had taken more notes and I could just reveal them all here. If I were a good, film reporter, I would have done this. But the one thing that struck me was that Tropical Malady, I've always sort of liked the fact that it came out the same year as Brokeback Mountain. Never really cared much for Brokeback Mountain, the melodrama that it was. But there are some similarities. Mm-hmm. There is a Tropical Malady is about a young man who falls in love with a boy who may or may not sort of reciprocate that, mm-hmm. that may not feel the same way, but isn't rude to him or anything like that. And I remember thinking, is rural Thailand more progressive than I realize? I don't know these things. I don't really know about that, you know. And I remember the mother, the older mother in the movie, she always wanted him to meet a nice boy, you know. And something about this was just like, wow, I just can't imagine that happening in the U.S. Well, then in Berkeley, when Peachapong was able to sit down and talk about this movie, one of his concepts of the film was that this is a universe where this isn't noteworthy. Is the idea of one of the ideas of the movie, and there are many. It isn't solely about this, like maybe Brokeback Mountain is.
Right.
This is just a universe where that isn't an issue, and so that's not what it's about. So it's so much that it's not what it's about. It's almost like a fantasy. Mm. And then there are other things in the movie that he pointed out that I hadn't picked up on. They're like, oh yeah, I guess that is a little bit unusual. Mm. But not knowing the culture sort of makes me question those things. And I had that same experience here in Uncle Boonmi.
Oh, how so?
At one point, a ghost appears, yes. And they're surprised. Okay. But they're surprised in the way that I'd be surprised if my mom walked in the door here. My mom is very much alive. She doesn't live in this state, and I'm not expecting her. So I would be surprised if she walked in here, and I'd have some questions. But that's about the level of surprise. Yes. And I was thinking, well, you know, if you believe in reincarnation, if you believe in ghosts, maybe this is something that you wouldn't be totally stunned by. But I also have a feeling there's a little bit of a wink there, because one of the characters says, I think you should be rejoicing that you're getting to see her again. And Uncle Boomy's like, oh, I am. You know, it just seems so muted. I
well,
laughed.
It's fantastic that a second ghost appears. You know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, look at, and your mom is here.
So yeah, it was. But I laughed, and I felt like it was intended to be funny. And I love that sense of humor. It's so unsettling.
The scenes when the ghost appears is a very nice one, I think, for a lot of reasons. But part of why I love it is Joe's lighting. You know, it's set at night, and they're all sitting around this table outdoors, and so there's just this one light above them. And it's just exquisite how dark everything is, except for sort of them lit around this table. And there's several scenes like that where he's doing really, really great things with lighting. There's a lot of scenes where everything's lit from the back, either windows in the back or like the scene with the princess and the catfish is this unbelievably beautiful waterfall in the background that sort of throws light upon everything else. And so it's just... it's exquisite cinematography and the way that he sort of shapes these scenes and frames these scenes with various approaches of lighting.
I also thought that he was really having fun shooting this on film. Mm. This is shot on film. It's not shot on digital video. And some of those scenes, like the cow at the very beginning that you were talking about, or some of those very, very dark scenes, not the one where they're sitting at the table because there's a bright light in the middle, but the scenes where you're just looking at like under a tree in the dead of night, moonlit. I have a feeling those were shot in the day, like they used to do in old movies. You know, there's this a Carl Dreyer's movie, Odette, has this scene where they're chasing Johannes, if I remember right.
That's right. That's right.
And it's supposed to be midnight, but the shadows under the trees are so sharp that it's like, man, that moon is really shining. You know, they put a filter on it so that it looked a little darker, but he had the difficulty of shooting in black and white, and so you could just really tell this was shot at noon. Mm. And I really think that Joe may have shot these in the daytime, but he has color, so it's blue that you're seeing. You're seeing this sort of blue haze. And because they're... some of them are in the jungle. You have this diffuse light anyway. And so I think I would love to know what time of day he shot a few of these, because it's so dim that it feels like something unusual is going on here.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there are those scenes where three of the characters go into these caves. And he's shooting, I mean, it appears to be some kind of flashlight, but it's obviously much more than that. But the way he's creating shadows within these caves I'd never seen anything like that before. I was thinking, wow, that is really amazing just to sort of watch it. I mean, and it goes on a while. Mm-hmm. And not much is happening. And so you almost get the sense that Joe is just saying, look how cool this is. I mean, this is really fantastic. And so, just sort of the There's a part of the film I think that's just almost pure cinema, and the joy of watching sort of light passing through film.
There's layered on top of that this whole symbolic stratus too, I think, because in that case they're going. We've already seen the fish and the princess thing, which we were saying felt sort of ancient or old. Well, this feels almost like Dawn of Man kind of thing, where they're literally walking back into a cave, and there are drawings on the cave walls. And Uncle Bunmi says something like, "I was born here. I can't quite place it, but I'm pretty sure I was born here." And you think, what in the world is he talking about? maybe it would make sense that he die here too. It's like this complete circle of life.
Absolutely. And then the next morning, the way he's shooting sort of sunlight and shadows is hard to describe, but if you get a chance to see it, it really is striking and gorgeous. I think in that scene, does someone actually refer to the womb, the cave, as being like a womb? I actually wrote that in my notes, and then later on I realized, wait, did someone say that, or did I just write that?
Did J. Robert Park say that, or did, I don't know who said that, but that's pretty cool. I'll have to watch it again to find out. There were some shorts recently that he made. After Syndromes in a Century, he showed a few different shorts at various festivals. One of them was called A Letter to Uncle Bunmi. And I didn't see that, but someone I know who saw that said that none of that actually, or very little of that, was in this film. And it makes me think that maybe he always works this way, but he may also be in this sort of period of experimentation more so than we even talk about, where Syndromes in a Century felt experimental, but it felt very constructed and like, mm-hmm. I want to do this in this exact way. Right. But this one almost feels improvisational in a sense. Mm-hmm. So when I think about it that way, I sort of warm up to the lower degree of structure, I think, that's in this movie.
So what do you make then of the last act, so to speak, which moves out of the countryside and into the city, where we have the young man who sort of leaves the Buddhist temple and he takes off his monk's robes, but there's also other characters he's interacting with, and then it sort of all there's a scene with a restaurant. How do you work that into this?
It's very mysterious, and I love it just on that level. It's like, I don't know what's going on here, but also the sort of visceral reaction that I have is that suddenly it feels real. Like, we were talking about ghosts, we were talking about a princess mating with a fish, we're talking about all kinds of crazy stuff, and now we're just in a room. They're counting. They're looking through the cards that they've received after Uncle Bunmi has passed away, and they're sort of making notes of who they need to send thank you cards to, and people have given them money and things. And then the young man comes in, who was he takes off his monk robe, his saffron robes, and he's sort of joining them. It sort of feels like peeling away all of the mysticism in a sense of the rest of the film. And then a very mystical thing happens.
Well, and I agree with that, but for me, I had a slightly different reaction to it, which is that it feels so sterile to me.
Yeah.
And so, maybe more real, but so less interesting and less, not that I dislike that part, but
no, I'm
made to feel, I like the fluorescent lighting is ugly.
Yeah.
And there's this scene that takes place in a temple, and it feels like a fairly standard Buddhist temple, you would think. And then suddenly he switches where the camera is, and there's this very garish neon, sort of altar behind it. And you're thinking, wow, that
like
is...
like Christmas lights. Blink,
yeah, it's
blink,
like
blink.
Spectacularly ugly. And so it's... I almost get a sense that there's sort of the ugliness of the real, or ugliness of modern, particularly urban life, because it's very particularly situated in an urban setting, as opposed to this sort of gorgeous, mystical, rural environment. And for me, the two, it's almost a bit too stark, I think. The one is so clearly better than the other, but that's that was sort of how it felt to me.
That could be subjective, because I can almost imagine that he sees it more as contrast than one being better than the other. One is certainly bright, and it's bright white, and those the colored lights. I know exactly what you're talking about, the blinking Christmas lights kind of thing. I don't know what to make of that, other than that it's very different from the rest of the movie, and I like that fact.
Did you expect him to go back to the countryside?
I don't know.
Yeah. I wasn't quite sure how I expected it to end. I will say I didn't expect it to end the way it did. But maybe that's not quite the right question to ask, because I think if you've seen Joe's films, you sort of realize that, you know, sort of wondering when they're going to end is a bit is a fruitless task. You just sort of surrender yourself to it. But when we did shift to the city, I suddenly started thinking of other Joe films that go in the reverse order. Typically, it's going from, as I think I said, city to countryside. And it's like, oh, well, this is an interesting shift. It feels different. And for me, I sort of was hoping that we might go back at some point, because I did enjoy the countryside so much more.
One thing that he didn't do in this film that was in Syndromes in a Century was that when the second half begins, it almost starts over, mm-hmm. and a lot of things are repeated, but with this sort of change, the second half has a lot of group-oriented stuff, and the first one is very individualistic, I think, where there's the rural village versus the city, these stark contrasts in the same way. And although those contrasts obviously exist in this movie, because they weren't split in half like that, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know maybe we're going to stay in this little room forever, or maybe we're going to go back to the jungle and we're going to see a cow. I have no idea what is coming up next in this movie. I almost have a better lay of the land in something like Syndromes in a Century.
But I'm sort of excited maybe to see it again.
Well, you know, it's the kind of movie that I actually feel like it may grow if I read more about it, even listen to him talk or something like that. You know, I feel like there are things in there that would not explain it to me, but that would give me even more to sort of grip into.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of the Plastic Podcast, but we do have another special AFI edition on Certified Copy, the film starring Juliette Binoche and directed by Abbas Kiarostami. You can find it at the AFI website. That's blog.afi.com/AFIFest, along with lots of other information about the festival. Or this podcast has a home on the web at dailyplastic.com. You can also find us as a free program on iTunes in the iTunes store. Just search for Plastic Podcast and Robert Davis and J. Robert Parks will pop up. If you have comments about this edition of the podcast or any other episode, you can leave them there at iTunes or at dailyplastic.com. Or if you'd like to record a voice message for us, call 415-287-4020. We'd love to hear from you. We'll be back next time with more stuff.